Let's review some basic facts. Before we jump into this Dead Sea Scroll, just some basic facts about sort of where we are and what the Dead Sea Scrolls are. And I've begun each session we've had with a commercial. I can't do that tonight because I lost an adapter or left at home, I think, an adapter between my laptop and the projector. So you will be commercial-free this evening. Although I'll simply say, once again, I direct a nonprofit called the Early Manuscripts Electronic Library that's involved in developing technology and applying those technologies to creating digital images of manuscripts. I'm preparing the first issue of our newsletter, and if you sign up and put your mailing address down, not just your email, you'll receive that very informative, exciting, and interesting to read newsletter. I'll do my best to make it all those things. But some basic facts about the Dead Sea Scrolls. What period of time we were talking about? In our very first session, I gave the period of time of the people of Qumran and Jesus a name. The period of something Judaism, the period of the something. Boy, those clues were excellent. This is the period we call Second Temple Judaism. Second Temple Judaism, and anything you read about the scrolls will normally assume you know what that term means. The First Temple of Solomon, the temple we read about in the Old Testament or Jewish Bible, was destroyed by the Babylonians. The Persians then destroyed the Babylonians, and the Persians allowed people to return to their native lands. They returned in about 512 BCE. We actually don't know exactly. The Second Temple was constructed. That Second Temple actually lasted longer than the First Temple. And it lasted from about 512 BCE until 70 AD when who destroyed it? The Romans. And with the Dead Sea Scrolls, we are in the second half of that Second Temple time period. And the very end of that Second Temple time period is the period of Jesus, of course. The oldest Dead Sea Scroll dates to, if anybody remembers or looks at notes they took or something like that, the oldest Dead Sea Scrolls date to about 250 BCE. Those are all biblical manuscripts, those earliest ones, and that stands to reason. The community at Qumran, the small settlement in the desert that we believe the Dead Sea Scrolls were their library, they built their settlement at about 125 BC. So when they built their settlement out in the desert, removing themselves from sort of the body politic of Judaism of the day, because they had a distinctive vision of what it meant to be Jewish. They had a distinctive interpretation of the Torah, the books of Moses, the first five books of the Bible, a distinctive and very strict interpretation of Torah. So strict, in fact, that they believed that the priests who controlled the temple had polluted the temple. Ritually, the temple was unclean because they believed the priests were not keeping the purity laws of the Torah strictly and accurately enough. And because those purity laws were not being kept strictly and accurately enough, the temple was polluted. They also believed that the priests of the temple were not accurately executing, implementing sacrifices according to the instructions in Leviticus and Numbers and the Torah. And because the priests were not accurate in their implementation of sacrifices, the sacrifices were inefficacious, invalid. So they believed the temple was impure, its rituals, its prayers, its festivals, its holidays, none of those things were meaningful. They removed themselves out in the desert to create a space in which they could realize their distinctive vision of Judaism. They were destroyed by the Romans in 68 AD, 2 years before the Romans would destroy Jerusalem. We found a layer of ash when the community was excavated. In six seasons of archaeology, from 1951 to 1956, the layer of ash showing that Romans burnt down this settlement. What we didn't find was, I mentioned this a few times.
We didn't find any writing or any scroll.
We didn't find any scrolls in the community. Actually, that's not something I've mentioned, but it's worth mentioning. We didn't find any bodies with Roman arrowheads in the body cavity. No skeletons with the Roman arrowheads sitting in the middle of it. So they did the smart thing. When the Romans approach, you hightail it into the hills. So the community went from 125 BCE to 68 AD. The scrolls, however, some of the scrolls appear to be 125 years older, dating to 250 BC. A copy of the book of Exodus, a copy of the book of Samuel, and a copy of the book of Jeremiah are the oldest among the Dead Sea Scrolls believed to go back all the way to 250 BCE. But the vast majority of what we call Dead Sea Scrolls date to the century immediately preceding the Common Era, immediately preceding the birth of Jesus. That century is when most of the scrolls were written. Let's see, what else? How many Dead Sea Scrolls are there?
900.
About 900. They were discovered in how many caves?
14.
11 caves. I heard 12 a couple of variants, but 11 caves. Of the 11 caves, which one was the mother lode where two-thirds of the scrolls came from that one cave? Four. Okay. Great. In cave four, none of the scrolls were in jars. There was only one scroll brought out of cave four still in the form of a scroll. But it was so deteriorated, so agglutinized together and so hardened, the process of unrolling it, you actually broke it apart. They broke it apart and kept the pieces in order. But so there is actually no scroll from cave four that looks like a scroll. And we saw images when I showed slides. Cave four is a giant puzzle. All the scrolls are in tiny, tiny pieces. A jigsaw puzzle where most of the pieces have been lost. For most Dead Sea Scrolls, we probably have less than 20% of the original surface area of that Dead Sea Scroll. Now, I divided the Dead Sea Scrolls into three categories of literature. The first one is obvious. There are scrolls of the Bible. Won't say Torah. It's a more inclusive than. There's every book of the Old Testament, Protestant Old Testament, or Jewish Bible, except for one, is found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Esther is not found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. All the other books are present. And there are 39 copies of the Book of Psalms. Kind of amazing. The most popular book at the time, just like today. 39 copies, and dwarfs the number of any other book, biblical book. There are about 20 of Genesis, about 20 of Deuteronomy, and about 20 of Isaiah. That's the second tier of the books of the Bible most found in this library. And guess which three, actually four books, of the Old Testament are quoted in the New Testament? Same books. Psalms, Genesis, Deuteronomy, and Isaiah. And these people, the writers of the New Testament, and the people of Qumran were contemporaries. And it would appear to stand to reason that the reason the New Testament quotes from those four books, and you find more of those four books than any other biblical books in the Dead Sea Scrolls, is because those are the books that were read and discussed most frequently in the Judaism at the time of Jesus. Any other? Okay, other categories of literature in the Dead Sea Scrolls, there are non-sectarian, general Jewish literature. Jewish literature that all Jews of the time period probably would have been familiar with at some level. And I gave an example of a rewritten book of Genesis called the Genesis Apocryphon. We talked a little bit about last week, where the book of Genesis was rewritten in the language of Aramaic, not the original Hebrew, and it was written expansively, where additional material was told about its characters. There are prayers and liturgical documents in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Another link to the New Testament. I mentioned last week that what's called the Magnificat, the prayer that Mary prays when she learns that she's to give birth to the Messiah, that starts out, "My soul magnifies." What happened? How did these two religions develop? How did we get these differences? Well, let's go on. Go to page 5. Here they finish talking about this ritual that they do every year out in the desert. Casting themselves subconsciously, imagining themselves inside the Bible, renewing their covenant with God annually. Paragraph 9 on page 5 begins blank, blank. That's literally a blank in the scroll. "They shall act this way year after year, all the days of Belial's dominion. They believe that they live in a period of the history of God's creation called the dominion of Belial, when Satan is in control. This is their consciousness. They live in a period of world history dominated by evil forces. The priest shall enter the rule," which actually is this document, "shall enter the rule foremost, one behind the other according to their spirits. And the Levites shall enter after them. In third place, all the people shall enter the rule, one after another. in thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. So that all the children of Israel may know their standing in God's community in conformity with the eternal plan. And no one shall move up from his rank, nor move down from his rank, nor up from the place of his lot, for his portion. For all shall be a single community of truth, of proper meekness, of compassionate love, and upright purpose, towards each other in the holy council. I love this phrase. Associates of an everlasting society. And anyone who declines to enter the covenant of God in order to walk in the stubbornness of his heart shall not enter the community of his truth, God's truth, since his soul loathes the restraints of knowledge and just judgment. Comments. Every year they're renewing their covenant with God, and that ceremony concludes with people entering under this rule. I guess pledging themselves to obey these rules. But comments, what do you see in this text? What do you observe?
It sounds like the reservation has moved in our own lots through gates of heaven, or vice versa?
We're going to move to the afterlife a little bit later, but right now this is an earthly ceremony. Although it's mimicking something, but go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, well, it sounds like they're saying equality, but on the other hand, they're saying you can't move up and you can't stand, or therefore all equal. You get that part. And then I started thinking, I think I've heard it to follow all those.
But we have a hierarchy. Notice the priests are first, the Levites, then all the people. But the hierarchy is more than that. That wouldn't be much of a hierarchy. We know from the Bible there are priests, there were Levites. Levites were one of the 12 tribes that had priestly duties at the temple. That makes sense. But then we get into this, the priests shall enter the royal forerunners, one behind the other. It appears to be a single file line. According to their spirits. Whatever that means. And then later we find according to their lots, their portion in God's plan, in conformity with the eternal plan. These people are ranked entering the covenant with God. And by the way, this is not a ceremony that's in Judaism today, yet it appears to be something they did, well, it says, year after year. This is a ritual, a ceremony, probably done at the New Year's festival each year, which they renewed their covenant with God. This is a form of Judaism which is wholly distinct from Judaism today, in which on their calendar they have an additional festival that isn't in Judaism today, a covenant renewal ceremony. And this is their covenant renewal ceremony.
Do you think it would be the Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement? Because that's what we do.
From other Dead Sea Scrolls, it appears the ceremony occurred at New Year's. And this, I mean, you could talk about Yom Kippur or something, you know, being renewing a covenant with God in the sense of reviewing sins from the year and things like that. But this is specifically a community renewing its covenant with God. A ceremony specifically focused on covenant renewal is unprecedented in rabbinic or classical Judaism. This is something, again, that's just totally different. This is a different form of Judaism. This is actually an extinct form of Judaism. So, we've gotten most of the points out of there. Let's move on. Let me see where I want us to go next. We're going to jump ahead a little bit. Paragraph number 12, one page over to page number 6. Paragraph number 12. Begins toward the top of page 6, where I have a little, there's a number 12, but it's the slash mark above the 12, where I define paragraph. It says blank 13 blank. So it begins, for the wise man. Now this is not a person who happens to be a fairly intelligent, educated guy. The wise man is a title. This is a leader in the community. This is an office in the community, the maskil, the wise man. So this is the part of the rule book that instructs him and in what his responsibilities will be in the community. For the wise man, that he may inform and teach all the sons of light about the history of all the sons of man, concerning all the ranks of their spirits, in accordance with their signs, concerning their deeds and their generations, and concerning the visitation of their punishment and the moment of their reward. From the God of knowledge stems all there is and all there shall be. Before they existed, he made all their plans, and when they came into being, they will execute all their works in compliance with his instructions, according to his glorious design, without altering anything. In his hands are the laws of all things, and he supports them in all their needs. What do you see? Comments or questions?
Predestination. Yeah, if you're in a son of the light, you are living according to a plan. And so it almost makes me think that if you have spirit and individuality, it's not according to God's plan. There isn't ego.
Loss of ego, living according to God's plan, if you're a son of light.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll look at that to see if this is exclusive to the son of light. But absolutely, if you're a son of light, you're living according to a predetermined plan. I heard the word predestination.
Right.
I think we need to go further than predestination and say determinism. Determinism. And we'll see more of this. Other comments? Sounds like good old Calvinism, Presbyterians, right, exactly. Well, and Calvinists, Presbyterians are good predestinationists, but this will take a step further. Even Calvin would turn in his grave over this, although Calvin wasn't nearly, well, that's a different discussion.
I mean, you're
so do you have free will in the context of this determinism? Great question. Great question. Some philosophers today would say actually that determinism and free will are consistent with each other because you're living freely, you don't know that all your actions are determined. But that's another discussion again. But clearly these people are pretty dang deterministic.
Well, it talks about they're in accordance with the ranks of their spirit. So they're living
Let's look at what the Maskil, the wise man, teaches about. He teaches the history of all the sons of man. I'll just assert that that's inclusive of the sons of light and the sons of darkness, which we'll run into in a moment. It's the history of everybody. He teaches concerning the history of all the sons of man. What are the subtopics within that within the history of all the sons of man? He teaches concerning all the ranks of their spirits. That come after spirit shouldn't be there. And the prepositions work out both in our English translation and in the Hebrew. He teaches concerning all the ranks of their spirits in accordance with their signs. So people are ranked, and he teaches that ranking. Concerning their deeds and their generations. Concerning what they do. But I think this is bigger than what individual people do. This is the history. Remember, we're living in the dominion of Belial. He teaches the history of all the sons of man in their generations. Okay, let's go on. What else does he teach? And concerning the visitation of their punishment and the moment of their reward. He teaches, in a sense, concerning the apocalypse, concerning the moment when God brings judgment to the world. The visitation is God's visiting our history in rewarding some and punishing others. So he teaches the ranking of people, which I'm going to say we'll see later is where they come from. He teaches the history of the generations of people, and then he teaches how history ends and the rewards and punishments of people. These people have, the people of Qumran have a cosmology that includes a history, and that history is divided up into periods, and they're living in the period of the dominion of Belial. The dominion of Satan. And in the future, there will be a moment, a visitation of God to reward and to punish, which will enter a new period, a new epic time. And so they have this big view of history in which they have this secret, esoteric knowledge that's not privileged to other people, where they talk about the rankings of people and of whole nations and societies. Where they talk about what people do across all the generations of history, and then where history will end. And this is the esoteric knowledge that is kept by the Maskil, the wise man, who teaches the esoteric knowledge within the community and probably transmits it to the next wise man. Make sense? And this kind of thinking continues today. I grew up in a very conservative Protestant church in which we talked about how the world will end, and there was a rapture, and then 7 years of tribulation, and then a millennial kingdom of Christ. And if you've ever heard these terms, well, don't worry about it right now, at least. But there was a periodization of history, of world history, derived from Scripture, and some, in my own opinion today, some really, you know, twisting of Scripture to do that, but a periodization of the history of the cosmos. This kind of thinking is relevant today as well. Let's go on. Where do I want to jump to next? Okay, paragraph 13, very next one. He created man to rule the world and placed within him two spirits so that he would walk with them until the moment of his visitation, to his being God. They are the spirits of truth and of deceit. And the hand of the Prince of Lights is dominion over all the sons of justice. They walk on paths of light. And in the hand of the Angel of Darkness is total dominion over the sons of deceit. They walk on paths of darkness. Due to the Angel of Darkness, all the sons of justice, the sons of light, stray. And all their sins, their iniquities, their failings, and their mutinous deeds are under his dominion in compliance with the mysteries of God until his moment. Again, that's the visitation. And all their punishments and their periods of grief are caused by the dominion of his enmity, the Angel of Darkness. And all the spirits of their lot cause the sons of light to fall. However, the God of Israel and the Angel of his truth assist all the sons of light. He created the spirits of light and darkness, and on them established all his deeds, all their paths, all his labors, and all their paths, all his labors. You see the little brackets there? That's actually a place where the scribe accidentally copied the same phrase twice. And our editor is showing that it's only meant to occur once, but our scribe made an error. God loved one of them for all eternal ages, and in all his deeds he takes pleasure forever. Of the other one, he detests his advice and hates his paths forever. Comments?
Prince of Light?
The Prince of Light. Yeah. How interesting.
Yeah.
Who is that? I don't know. But we have some sort of angelic figure called the Prince of Light, who has a corresponding demonic figure, the Angel of
Darkness.
Now, but let's back up first. Look at the top of what we read. Human beings, each of us, is ruled by two spirits. Spirit of truth, what's the language specifically used? Spirit of truth and deceit. Now this is thinking that that's ubiquitous in human culture. You watch a cartoon and there's a little angel on one shoulder, there's a little Satan on the other shoulder, and they're talking into the cartoon character's ears as they approach a moral decision. In Plato, you have, he says the human soul is like a chariot driver. And he's trying to, control these two steeds pulling the chariot. And you have this idea, these steeds are pulling this thing apart and the chariot driver has to control it. It's a similar kind of thinking. So all through human culture, we have the idea, we have the idea that the human psyche, the human soul, the human will, the human mind, whatever we want to use, is divided against itself. We're not a unitary, simple mechanism. We are divided against ourselves internally. And we're ruled by two spirits, truth and deceit. But what's interesting now is they write that large. Not only is there a battle between truth and deceit internal to each human being in the microcosm, there's a battle between truth and deceit in the macrocosm as well. That there is a Prince of Lights, some angelic supernatural figure who rules over the children of light, the sons of light, and there is an angel of darkness who rules over the children of darkness, the sons of darkness, the sons of deceit. And humanity is divided into two segments, the sons of light and the sons of darkness. And we have a battle in the cosmos between these two halves. Let's see, did we get to the language yet where he says, and God has set an enmity between them? Not quite. But these two sides are struggling against each other. There's an internal dispute and in the microcosm and the macrocosm, and the two mirror each other. The battle within the human soul mirrors the macrocosmic battle of the cosmos. Okay, let's go on. Let's jump down to 16. It's actually the next page, page 7. Paragraph 16 begins about a third of the way down the page where there's a blank 15 blank. In these lies the history of all men. In their two divisions, all their armies have a share by their generations. In their paths they walk. Every deed they do falls into their divisions, dependent on what might be the birthright of the man, great or small, for all eternal time. For God has sorted them into equal parts until the last day, and has put an everlasting loathing between their divisions. Deeds of injustice are in abhorrence to truth, and all the paths of truth are in abhorrence to injustice. There exists a violent conflict in respect of all his decrees, since they do not walk together. God, in the mysteries of his knowledge and the wisdom of his glory, has determined an end to the existence of injustice. And on the occasion of his visitation, he will obliterate it forever. Meanwhile, truth shall rise up forever in the world, which has been defiled in the paths of wickedness during the dominion of injustice, until the time of appointed judgment. Obviously, we're hitting on a theme pretty hard. What do you see in this step in the theme?
The truth will ultimately triumph. Justice will ultimately triumph.
Justice will ultimately conquer. But in the meantime, we have a stalemate. This is like the Battle of the Bulge. I mean, you know, there's a stalemate between darkness and light. The two are equally divided. There's an enmity between them. And there is no resolution to the conflict because they are equal. And I don't know if it said that in this paragraph, but it'll say it later, if not here. I don't know if we're going to get that far. But they are equally divided, and therefore at a stalemate during the dominion of Belial. Now, sorted into equal parts. Yes, thank you. Now notice, every deed they do falls into their divisions, dependent on what might be the birthright of the man, great or small, for all eternal time. So we have people, according to where you're born, you're a son of light or a son of darkness. According to where your birthrights, you have a particular portion or lot in God's plan. And remember their language earlier, when they enter the rule of the community, they enter one by one, according to their lot in God's plan, according to God's eternal plan. Now, let's look at another scroll for a second. Remember what we read before? That the maskil, the wise man, teaches about three things concerning all the ranks of their spirits in accordance with their signs. People are ranked, their spirits are ranked, according to their signs. Well, let me read to you from another Dead Sea Scroll. This one is very fragmentary. It's in Aramaic, actually, I think.
That's right.
In Aramaic, I think. And it's very fragmentary, so we don't have much. But I'll start in the middle, because that's the only place you can start. We're down at the beginning. His thighs are long and slender. The toes of his feet are slender and long. He is in the second position. His spirit has six parts in the house of light, and three in the pit of darkness. And this is the sign under which he was born, the foot of Taurus. He will be poor, and his animal will be the bull. Yeah, there's astrology here. Foot of Taurus. What else is there? He has long, slender legs. Here, he doesn't have a lot of bodily hair, this guy. Body type. And that's also a, not necessarily reputable, I started to say, but a thing that human cultures still do today. There was a lot of it in 19th century America, where people would look at your body shape, your body type, short, fat, skinny, tall, whatever, and they would then make extrapolations from that for your personality, your spiritual condition, your destiny in life, This has been done all the time. And we still size people up all the time by all sorts of arbitrary criteria. But they're mixing here astrology and body type analysis to say this person has six parts in the House of Light, three parts in the Pit of Darkness. If these are the Sons of Light, that person would be about right here. Now notice, each person has nine parts, so you can't be stuck in the middle, halfway light and halfway darkness. You're on one side of the divide and the other. Let me read another one. His teeth are of different lengths. The fingers of his hands are stumpy. I haven't looked at this in the Aramaic, but I'm wondering what the Aramaic word they translated stumpy is. His thighs are fat, and each one covered with hair. So if you're a short, stubby person with a lot of bodily hair, you're in trouble, because his spirit has eight parts in the House of Darkness and only one in the House of Light. So right here, right there. Question.
Does that imply that this is a permanent condition? This guy always has
I mean, you could shave the hair, but I don't think that changes your birthright. And remember, it says, according to your birthright, according to how you were born in God's eternal plan. Let me read another one. And notice, I doubt, we don't have the whole scroll, but I really doubt that anybody in this scroll would be all darkness, nine darkness, or nine light. Because remember, there's a battle internally. So probably the person who had only one part light and eight part darkness is as bad as you can get. And even the person most filled with light on that edge of the room will still have one part darkness. Next one. Let's see. His eyes are between clear and dark. Is this the other one? Nope, that's not the one. Here we go. The sound of his voice is plain. His teeth are sharp and well aligned. He is neither tall nor short, and like that from his birth. The fingers of his hands are slender and long. His thighs are smooth, and the soles of his feet are even. This person is sort of the knee, you know, the perfect knee, neither tall nor short. His spirit has eight parts in the House of Light, one in the House of Darkness, and the sign under which he was born is Virgo. No, it's not even that. It doesn't say the sign under which he was born. But this part of the person is nine parts, the House of Light. So we have a worldview of a cosmological battle, a final judgment, not in this scroll but elsewhere, a resurrection of the dead. That cosmological battle occurs internally in each individual and cosmologically. That cosmological battle is in a stalemate until the time when God visits and evil is obliterated forever and the reign of justice and righteousness begins. And we have esoteric knowledge in which they understand all the nations of the world and all the history of the world within this divine plan, the knowledge of which is only given to their leadership. And we'll pick this up after a break. One question, Jane?
Isn't this predestination?
Determinism. I'll go further. It's determinism. We'll pick this up after the break, and we'll start talking about what does this mean, and we'll look at the other handouts and start to generalize about Judaism in this time period. About 7-8 minutes.